It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Not all poetry is about love and happiness. Writer and Mercer English professor Anya Silva often writes about depression, fear, and living with cancer. But her latest collection, Second Bloom, is also about life and joy. Silva earned the title of Georgia Author of the Year for Poetry in 2015 and is currently author of 4 poetry collections. Poet and English professor Anya Silva joins me now from our Macon studios. Hi, Anya.
Hi, Celeste. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you back. And I was interested from the very beginning, you chose to start the book with a quote from the Bible. Mm-hmm. And it says, "Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of countenance the heart is made glad." And I wonder, why did you start with a quote that says sorrow is better than laughing?
Well, a couple of reasons. I think that when people go through sorrow or trauma of some sort, they grow in a way that they might not if their lives were completely happy. And it's possible to gain wisdom from that. But also that if you experience sorrow, you truly understand the moments of joy and happiness in a new and more vibrant way. So that quote in Ecclesiastes has always spoken to me for that reason.
One of your poems said that when you're sad, I don't remember the exact wording, but it was said when you're sad, you read the Psalms. Why?
Yes. I find the Psalms incredibly comforting. The celebratory Psalms remind me of the beauty of life, and that sort of ennobles my life. And the poems about suffering make me feel less alone, and I realize that I'm not the only person in the world going through something painful, and that there's a whole community of people who are going through difficult times, and that sense of community is really valuable to me. And just in general, the idea that there is a God to whom I can speak, whether it's in happiness or anger, is something that sustains me.
So, as always, your poetry is very honest and straightforward. And I was struck by the very first poem. You sort of lay it out, and there's a couple lines in there where you say, "I don't know why I'm still alive," which sort of hit me like a dagger. And you follow it with, "I don't know how a line of poetry sometimes loses itself and finds me." And I wondered, you're basically beginning your book of poetry by saying, "I'm not sure why poetry has power over me," in a way.
Right.
How come?
Well, it's always been a mystery to me how I write poetry, and I'm not saying this in any sort of self-aggrandizing way, but sometimes I feel like poetry comes from the outside, comes from something transcendent, and it's always a miracle to me when I think of a line of poetry, not knowing whether it's coming from just my neurons firing or whether there's some transcendent force, what God or the divine or the universe or whatever working through me. And it's the same thing about life. I don't know why I'm alive and why my friends have died. There's no reason for that. It just is. And dealing with why that is, well, there's no answer for it. I have to deal with it. It's just what I cope with and think about every day.
Well, let's go back to this issue of the divine, because it comes up a lot in this new book of poetry. And I want to read a couple lines that struck me, because you, in many poems, you seem to be sort of having a conversation with the divine. And at the end of one, you say, "Merciful one, begotten of woman, understand how difficult it is to trust that you are kind."
Yeah, that's one of my anger poems. Well, you know, I was raised in the Christian faith, and I'm still a Christian. And so we're raised with this idea of the ever-loving, omnipotent God. And that, to me, has always been really theologically a problem because I don't – and, of course, it has been for so many people – because I don't know why a loving God would allow a young woman with children to die a horrible death. And so in that poem, I was thinking about a very good friend of mine who died, and she had 2 children. And it was Christmas, and we were thinking about the goodness of God and Christ. And I was thinking, well, what's the proof that God is good in the world? What's the proof that God loves us when we see people around us suffering? And I didn't really have an answer for that. So I was just telling God, well, sometimes I don't really trust you. I don't know what you're thinking. I guess I believe in a faith that has room for anger toward God and questioning of God, and I don't feel like that's incompatible with being a person of faith.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author, poet, and Mercer English professor Anya Silver. And then the second section of the book, I mean, you mentioned Christmas. The second section is centered around holidays, Christmas,
right.
New Year's, Lent, Easter. And it occurred, you know, I was thinking about it as I read these poems, that especially when you have kids, those holidays are really important. Like, those are the markers that create your memories of childhood, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly, right.
And that was my question. I said, I wonder if that's where this comes from. Like, these holidays become sort of the mile markers. These are the places that allow you to sort of count the passage of time.
Right. Well, in the Episcopal Church, we have long periods of time that are called ordinary time, but then we also have these periods of Lent and holidays. And I'm a very ritualistic person, and so I really organize my life around certain holidays and certain mile markers like birthdays or Christmas or Easter. And those are always the times that appear most strongly in my memory and that I try to live most consciously. And there are also times when I talk to women who are sick that the women want to live for. They say, I want to make it to the next Christmas. I want to make it to the next Easter. There's just a way in which those holidays give us a sense of time in our lives when time is so amorphous. And it also makes those holidays difficult because it puts so much weight on them. We feel so much pressure for those days to be perfect and to survive us in memory.
I wonder if you would read a poem for me. I think it's from the third section. It's called Noah.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, the name, your son's name, I mean, since we're speaking about faith and speaking about the Bible, obviously your son's named after a very important man of faith from the Bible, which to me made the poem itself all that more poignant. Would you read it for us?
Do you mean the Psalm for Noah?
Yes, Psalm for Noah.
Yes, okay. Yes, this is Psalm 137 for Noah, and it's based on Psalm 137. Psalm 137 for Noah. Come, darling, sit by my side and weep. I have no lyre, no melodious voice or chant. I meditate on the Zion I could never grant you. My son, my roe deer, my rock rent stream, my honeysuckle, my salt, my golden spear. Forgive me your birth in this strange land. I wanted your infant caresses, your fists clasped around my neck. I craved you, though you were born in the wake of my illness, my dim prognosis. I was selfish. I willed you this woe, this world. You inherited exile for my sake.
So there are conflicting thoughts going on here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
It sounds as though you feel in a way guilty that you brought this child into the world knowing that you may not be there to see all his future birthdays.
Yes. I was diagnosed originally with cancer in 2004 when I was pregnant, and my son is really the joy of my life. I mean, I feel so lucky to have him. But there is always this guilt. And I think all parents probably feel this to some degree when they see terrible things happening in the world. But there's always the sense of guilt for me that if something terrible happens to me, if I die young, that I will have brought him pain in bringing him life. And I question to myself whether it's right to bring a child into the world when you guarantee that child pain. But the thing is, that's the case for everybody. I mean, everybody who has children knows that their child is going to suffer, and we just have to, I guess, in my case, I decided that the joy of life and the beauty and connection of life were more important than the chances of suffering. But it's certainly something I think about a lot, and I do feel some guilt about it.
Do you talk with him about that?
No, not specifically.
But he's read the poem.
I don't know if he has. He probably will after this broadcast.
Because he's what, 14, 13?
He's 13, and we do talk about it. I haven't talked to him about this because I don't want him to sense that I have any regrets about his birth, which, of course, I don't. But being a parent just comes with so many conflicting emotions, and it's so intense and overwhelming. And sometimes we do have these feelings that we don't like to talk about. And I wanted to just be completely honest with the fact that I felt them, even though when I said to people sometimes, oh, it was wrong to have a child considering my health, they are shocked and upset that I would say that. But I think it's something that people feel, and I just wanted to be honest about it.
Well, you are incredibly honest, and your poetry always has been, as I mentioned, but I wanted to read another section from a poem because one of the things that struck me is how often it sounds like you're saying, I don't know how to make poetry out of what's happening to me,
right,
while you're making poetry out of what's happening to you.
Right.
So there's a part where you say, today when I could be writing, I sit waiting mm-hmm. for a nurse to access me, that is, puncture me with a needle. I cannot work because of the talk, the cold room, the television's jabber, the microwave smells of grease and burn. I want words, but my mind stalls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you do that? I mean, you are addressing some, very, in some cases, prosaic. You curse mm-hmm. a couple times in the poetry.
Yes, I do. I'm sorry. Well, one thing that I've on the one hand, cancer has been this mine of amazing subject matter for me, just like, you know, my family has and my husband has been. But on the other hand, it takes so much time to be a patient. It takes so much time to be ill. Anatole Breuer, who wrote for the New York Times, said that patients are the best people at waiting because we learn to just spend huge amounts of our time waiting. And so sometimes I do resent my illness and resent my body for getting in the way of me being able to write. So I resent the fact my body is too tired to write or that my mind is too tired. And sometimes I worry that that will keep poetry from it will keep me from writing poetry, and I just have to trust that poetry is this mother tongue that will come back to me despite the fact that my body sometimes feels like it's failing me, and I do feel a lot of hostility towards my body for preventing me from doing what I want to do.
What is the benefit in presenting these very uncomfortable images for people, presenting to them these very, mm-hmm. in some cases, frustrating and in some cases upsetting images into poetry?
Well, I think that as a culture, we are very illness phobic. We don't talk about it a lot. We're very death phobic. And I want to resist that narrative and to be able to speak honestly about the difficulties of life, both for people who are experiencing it and might feel alone in their experiencing, and also for people who haven't experienced it so that they can understand what it's like to feel this pain and uncertainty. So I think that good writing has to be honest. And if it's not completely honest, then it's not living up to what it could do. And so there are poems that I write that I wouldn't publish, but for me, there should be nothing taboo in terms of writing about, because a writer's job is to bring the truth to the world, his or her truth. And if my truth is uncomfortable for people, then that isn't really my problem. My job is to bring my truth to the world, and my truth isn't always pretty.
And yet it's this, for me at least as a reader, it occupies an odd space because it's mm-hmm. escapist for me because the writing is beautiful and it is the opposite of escapist
right?
because it is extremely real. This is about death and mm-hmm. life and what you choose with these moments. And in one of the poems you describe being at a meeting, a real meeting mm-hmm. in which you mentioned cancer and everyone kind of looks away. And the reason I know that it's real is because when I posted that poem on Facebook, somebody wrote, I was at that meeting.
Oh, goodness. Uh-oh. People are just so uncomfortable with illness. And the thing is, I'm not uncomfortable talking about it. I'm not uncomfortable joking about it. I'm not really uncomfortable with death. I think death is just a natural part of the human process. And there's a poem I have called Nocturne in which I refer to withered petals alongside sumptuous ruffles. Well, you wouldn't have the sumptuous ruffles of joy and belonging and life if you didn't have those withered petals. You can't have one without the other. And so I have a tremendous amount of joy in my life, and my joy coexists with pain. I don't see those two things as completely separate. I think all of life is woven together, and separating the strands is impossible. So I'm comfortable talking about those things and still being a happy person.
That is poet and Mercer University English professor Anya Silver. Her latest book of poetry is called Second Bloom. She'll give a reading tonight at the Decatur Public Library at 7:15. Anya, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Celeste. I really appreciate being here.